In a recent Gallup poll, 91% of Americans said infidelity was morally wrong. That was ahead of polygamy, human cloning, and way ahead of divorce. But a lot of people do it. A lot of people do it. Estimates of 26 to 70% of women, 33 to 75% of men, women are catching up with men, closing what's been called the infidelity gap. This is just some of the hard research that is in this terrific and at times unbearable book. The rest is the often heartbreaking stories gathered in Esther Perel's therapy practice. And there are the questions she raises. We heard a couple. What is an affair? Is a Facebook account, a secret Facebook account, an affair? Adultery has always hurt. Why is it hurting more now? Some therapists are borrowing from the field of trauma to treat it. Why is that? Can a marriage survive it? Esther writes, discovering an affair is eviscerating. If you really want to gut a relationship, tear the heart out of it. Infidelity is a sure bet. But wait. Elsewhere, she writes, an affair can fix what's wrong in a marriage. Is that possible? Can you forgive an affair? Beyonce did, although poor Becky with the good hair, one of her songs. We want to ask a lot of questions of Esther, and you will get to do that at the end of our conversation. And isn't it kind of interesting to have this conversation about infidelity in Old South Church? We're going to get struck by lightning as we exit. But what we want to do is start with Esther, with some of her thoughts, maybe a little bit of reading from the book. Please welcome Esther Perel.
May I ask, how many of you are currently in a relationship? How many of you would like to be in a relationship? And how many of you would like to be out of the relationship you're in? At least on occasion. You see, we all live in networks of relationships. But if you think about friendship, it hasn't changed too much in the last 150 years. Sibling relationships haven't changed too much. And yet there is one unit that has literally undergone an extreme makeover, and it's the couple. And the couple today experiences more pressure to be happy, to do well, to be perfect, than any other unit, with an expectations for relationships that are at an all-time high, and often experienced quite in isolation. Couples are often quite isolated. In heterosexual couples, maybe women may speak to women, men talk to nobody. When it comes to sex, people lie. Men lie by exaggerating and boasting. Women lie by minimizing and denying. And when it comes to forbidden sex, it is shrouded in secrecy and in shame. So I've been a couples therapist for almost 35 years. I've worked with hundreds of people who've been shattered by the crisis of an affair. And if I was to ask you, how many of you, and don't raise your hand right away, would say that you have been affected by the experience of infidelity in your life, as in the child of a parent who was unfaithful and maybe left or fell in love with another person, the offspring of an illicit love, the friend whose shoulder is wet from somebody weeping on it for days, the friend who's the confidant of someone else who's in the throes of an affair, the three protagonists and the person who often closes the triangle. How many of you would say you've been affected by the experience of infidelity in your life? Okay. It's about 80%. And yet, this is a subject that is rarely spoken about. I don't know why, but I have an obsession about talking about the stuff nobody wants to talk about. I mean, I do know why, but that's not for right now. And infidelity has existed since marriage was invented. Regardless of the models of marriage, it existed in the traditional marriage, it existed in the romantic marriage, and it is existing in the self-actualization marriage or committed relationship. It exists in happy relationships, in poor relationships, in open relationships. It happens. In fact, I'm actually going to read this to you, probably better to say it like that. At this very moment, in all corners of the world, someone is either cheating or being cheated on, thinking about having an affair, offering advice to someone who's in the throes of one, or completing the triangle as a secret lover. No aspect of a couple's life elicits more fear, gossip, and fascination than an affair. Adultery has existed since marriage was invented, and so too the taboo against it. It has been legislated, debated, politicized, and demonized throughout history. Yet, despite its widespread denunciation, infidelity has a tenacity that marriage can only envy. So much so that it is the only sin that gets two commandments in the Bible. Once for doing it, and once just for thinking about it. In every society, on every continent, and in every era, regardless of the penalties and the deterrents, men and women have slipped the confines of matrimony. Almost everywhere people marry, monogamy is the official norm, and infidelity the clandestine one. So what are we to make of this time-honored taboo, universally forbidden, yet universally practiced? The revelation of an affair can be wrecking, and it's no surprise that most people want to take sides. So whenever I tell people that I'm writing a book about infidelity, the immediate reaction usually is, are you for or against? As if there were only two options. My answer is yes. And behind this cryptic response lies my sincere desire to initiate a more nuanced and less judgmental conversation about infidelity and its concomitant dilemmas. The intricacies of love and desire don't yield to simple categorizations of good and bad, victim and culprit. So before I even begin this conversation, to be clear, not condemning doesn't mean condoning. And there is a world of difference between understanding and justifying. But when we reduce the conversation to simply passing judgment, we are left with no conversation at all. So what has happened? How did we get to this notion that infidelity is worse than cloning, than suicide, than polygamy? How has it become the deal breaker, one of the leading causes for divorce? For one, I think just so we clear this up from the start, the conversation about infidelity has never, ever been a gender equal proposition. Men throughout history practically had a license to cheat, and women still have 9 countries where they can be killed just for straying. So when we say that men cheat because they're bored and they need novelty and they are natural roamers, whereas women only cheat because they're hungry for love and lonely and miserable, it may have less to do with the motives as the consequences. If the consequences were less dire for her, maybe she wouldn't have to wait till she's at her wit's end. And that means that for anything to change, historically, it needed the democratization of contraception. We knew what infidelity was, because there was a pregnancy most of the time with a child that came out whose color of hair was not the same as mine. But today, it is a lot more fluid. So we live for a long time in small villages in which our relationships are primarily regulated by rules and by duty and by obligation. And in that village, people know who they are. You have a sense of identity, you have a sense of belonging, and you know your role. You have very little freedom, but you know who you are. And infidelity in that context, where marriage is more of a pragmatic arrangement, has always been an economic threat, primarily for women who could face destitution, ostracism, mortality, pregnancy, all of those things. And as we evolve into a romantic model of relationships, where we begin to choose our partner, where we begin to experience more freedom, we also experience more aloneness. And as we start to be more alone, intimacy is no longer just a byproduct of relationships, it becomes the essence of the relationship. And it no longer just means that we're going to work the land and feed the kids and milk the cows. Intimacy today is into me see. And into me see is that I'm going to share with you not just my economic assets, but my internal assets, my internal life, my feelings, my obligations, my worries, my aspirations, my dreams. And when I talk to you, I want to be able to experience momentarily how I can transcend this existential aloneness. We bring love to marriage. We bring sex to love. For the first time, we separate sex from reproduction. Passion has always existed. It just didn't exist inside committed relationships. It was often way too dangerous as well. But now we, for the first time, have a model of sexuality in long-term relationships, which is for connection and for pleasure. Because after all, why do it? Why experience it if you've had the two children you wanted? So sexuality is rooted in desire. It is no longer rooted just as a procreation model. And then we'd bring happiness down from the heavens. You know, for most of this history, happiness belonged to the afterlife. And you suffered well on earth, and maybe you were rewarded later. But today, we want to be happy. We deserve to be happy. It's not like we have more desires than we used to have or than my grandmother had, but we certainly feel more entitled to pursue them. And then we create another major shift. With the secularization of society all over the West, for the first time, when we say the one and only, we don't mean God. We mean my partner. And we talk about soulmates, and we conflate the spiritual and the relational. And we look for, in our partnerships, ecstasy, wholeness, belonging, meaning, all kinds of things that used to belong to the sanctuary of the divine. Now we want them as part of our earthly love. So here are a few big shifts. We used to marry and we had sex for the first time. Today we marry and we stop having sex with others. We used to think of monogamy as one person for life, and today monogamy is one person at a time. And many of you probably would comfortably say, I am monogamous in all my relationships. Plural. We used to divorce. No, let's begin early. We used to not be able to divorce. There was no exit. And yet, as there was no exit, the best thing you could hope for was an untimely death if you were really miserable. Then we got an option to leave. And yet, none of the options to leave have rendered infidelity obsolete. So that became one of my central questions. Why? Why is it still so rampant? And then, we no longer just divorce because we are unhappy, but today we divorce because we could be happier. And all of these things are happening at the same time as we are also choosing a partner between 1,000 people at our fingertips. And so when I find that one and only, that today means a few things, but among those things, what it says is, you are the one who's cured me of my case of FOMO. You are the one for whom I'm going to delete my apps. When you are the one and only, and you have waited 10 more years of sexual nomadism before you even enter into committed relationships that you think will be life stories, you bet that infidelity becomes the grand shattering of the ambition of love. And for the first time, it is not just painful, it becomes traumatic. And it becomes an experience that is gutting to my identity, to my sense of trust, not just of you, but of my own perceptions. And I don't know anymore what's real. And I start to retell the entire story of my relationship, even when it's 26 years ago. And for 26 years, there was no infidelity in my relationship. When this crisis occurs, people think that it speaks a truth that is bigger than anything that preceded. And yet, we all know that betrayal happens in all kinds of ways in relationships. But for some reason, this betrayal, because of the uniqueness of the romantic ideal, has taken over above all other betrayals. So I work with people all over the world, and I ask them, you know, because one of the things that happens often in the immediate aftermath of the revelation of an affair, there's two things that happen. Either you have affairs that are breakup That's it. The relationship was already dying on the vine, and this is just the end. But sometimes you have relationships that are makeup. And when I speak about the fact that out of a crisis, people can come out stronger, more resilient, more robust, very quickly I'm often asked, would I recommend people to have an affair? To which I finally came up with an answer that I could live with, which was, so many people will tell you that if they have a life-threatening illness, it gives them a new perspective on life. And yet nobody would recommend them to have cancer. So I would no more recommend you to have an affair than I would recommend you to get sick. That said, we grow from experiences that sometimes can almost annihilate us. We do. And not just, and that doesn't mean it's good, but that means that sometimes good can come out of it. And then I began to look at the vocabulary. You know, there is no morally neutral language to speak about infidelity. Liar, cheater, perfidy, womanizer, philanderer, slut, it just goes on and on. Only in the arts, only in fiction and in movies and in the opera, do people talk about love stories. And they don't just look at the impact of the affair, but they also look at the meaning and the motives. And so I really wanted a model that included a dual perspective. What it did to you, but also what it meant to me. And one of the great findings in this research for this book, which I started in 2009 worldwide, was that, you know, people would come to me and they would say, I love my partner, I'm having an affair. That flies against the symptom model. The symptom model goes directly with the one and only. If you found the one and only, which is the person who is going to give you everything, everything means everything traditional marriage was going to give you, family life, children, companionship, economic support, all of that. And on top of it, that person is going to be your best friend, your trusted confidant, your passionate lover. One person to give you what once an entire village used to provide. So, I'm going to jump. I'm going to read, actually. I don't know about the time here, but in the aftermath, there are sometimes three major outcomes of the people who stay together. And I called them the sufferers, the survivors, and the explorers, borrowing from Helen Fisher's categories. But what I was really interested in is what makes for the explorers? Who are the people for whom this experience may even yield a new relationship and that typically will tell me a better relationship than the one that they may even have had before? These are the people for whom an affair becomes a catalyst for transformation. These explorers come to see infidelity as an event that, though insanely painful, contained the seeds of something positive. When faced with the collapse of the world they knew, these couples home in on each other with a level of intensity they haven't experienced in years. It is not uncommon for them to experience a combustive rekindling of desire that is a potent mixture of anxiety and lust. Fear of loss is the spark plug that sets it up. They're deeply engaged, in pain and alive. The explorers have taught me much about what lies at the core of resilient relationships. Madison and Dennis always struck me as being that kind of a couple. The uncovering of his affair threw them into turmoil, but I remember noting during our sessions that they had an uncanny ability to express and accept a wide range of feelings without demanding premature closure. Their tolerance for ambiguity and uncertainty opened up a space for exploration in which they could more deeply connect. In contrast with the sufferers who conceive of their ideal in moral absolutes, the viewpoint of explorers is more fluid. They more readily distinguish wrong from hurtful. paving a smoother road for clemency. When they speak about the affair, it is clear that they identify it as one event, not the definitive event in their long history together. One sign that they have successfully metabolized this appears in their language. They shift from you and me, what you did to me, to our. When we had our crisis, recounting a shared experience. Above all, they know that there are no clear-cut answers, and they're able to discuss the betrayal with a fundamental acceptance of human flaws. Madison and Dennis's relationship feels much richer and more interesting, but it can also feel less secure. They have added novelty to the enduring, mystery to the familiar, and risk to the predictable. I'm not sure where all of this is going to take us, but dull it certainly is not, Dennis says. If before they were facing dead ends, now they don't know where they'll end up. But the very fact is more this very fact is more exciting than frightening, and they are in it together. To repair is to repair. When people tell me that they love their partner and yet they're having an affair, I began to understand something very clear. If the notion of the symptom is you only do this because there must be something missing, either there's something missing in your relationship or there's something missing in you. If you had everything at home, why would you go looking elsewhere? We are rooted in a symptom model, which obviously condemns the relationship and the other person for why this happens. What people began to tell me more and more is this: at the heart of affairs lies betrayal and lying and deception and all of that. But at the heart of affairs also often lies longing and loss. And for those people, when they look to the gaze of another, it isn't because they want to leave their partner, but they actually want to leave the person that they have themselves become. It's not that they want to reject their relationship. It's not that they want another person. They want a different version of themselves. They have been for 20 years in a caretaking role as the wife, as the mother, as the caregiver of the elderly parent, as the parent of a disabled child. They have been in responsibility mode forever. These are as committed people as they come. And yet, maybe for the first time, they're doing something for themselves, and they don't know how to do it in the context of the relationships that needs them for everything. And so, secluded from the world, in this world of secrecy, they are able to reimagine themselves the way they maybe once were, or the way that they have never been allowed to be. And it is those stories that really made it clear for me that we need a new conversation for the oldest sin, one that brings compassion to all involved. To all involved. Children who can understand their parents, partners who need to understand themselves and each other. There is no homewrecker in the masculine. There is no other man. I have a whole chapter on the other woman, because more and more dozens and dozens of women were writing to me and saying, please, can you write about us? Children were asking, can we write about us? And so what became clear is this is systemic. This is intergenerational. This is not just a story of two people. This cannot be simplified in black and white, good and bad, and it certainly cannot be criminalized in victims and perpetrators. There is nothing criminal about it. It's hurtful. Some people think it's wrong, but it really needs to be understood so that people can experience this crisis and come through it without the shame and the secrecy that it's shrouded in. The biggest thing is this. Today, one major change has taken place. For most of history, and certainly once we could, divorce carried all the shame. Divorce was the stigma. Today, choosing to stay when you can leave is the new shame. For everything, people say, leave. Throw the dog on the curb. Get out. Without any understanding sometimes of how complex a tapestry a relationship is and all the intersections that take place in this. So now you've betrayed me, you've lied to me, but I have to protect you to our friends because I don't want them to know what you've done to me, because otherwise they're going to judge me for still loving you. And so now I am caught with two lies. And I'm sure that in this room, there are people who recognize this. So it's for all of this that I wrote The State of Affairs. It's a book about the exploration of modern love through the lens of one of our worst crises, because nobody learns from just studying Apple and Google. You learn because you go into the trenches and you see where people are disillusioned at their most, and then from there are able to create a new story for themselves. Many people will tell me that they've had conversations at a level of depth and openness like they haven't had in years. You wish people had these conversations early on. That would have been part of the affair proofing, if such a thing exists. You are so quiet. Are you breathing or are you apoplectic? Shall we stop?
Yes, Esther Perel. I think afterwards you'll have an opportunity to get the book and have a signing, and I have a feeling we should each also pay her $150 for the advice. Look, you talked about how much more painful it is now because people are making their marriage their spirituality, their religious life. And you have a quote from Simone de Beauvoir in one of the chapters. "I used to think I knew who I was, who he was. Suddenly I don't recognize us. My entire life, as I've led it up to this moment, has crumbled." How painful does it get? You have one woman who's diagnosed with PTSD. You have a man whose wife is cheating, who's lying in the bed with a gun in his mouth. How painful is it?
It can be excruciatingly painful. It's everything. But it's everything because, in part, I didn't believe this could happen. I have a feeling, I mean, many people have written about that, that we're in the, you know, in the parts of the world where women, in this instance, experience this as part of the possibilities of the landscape of marital life, they are hurt, but they are not destroyed. And in part, it's also because they don't live in those parts of the world in as individualistic a society by which, you know, Americans have lost between 30 and 60% of their social capital in the last 25 years, meaning people that you reach out to when you have important experiences in your life. The partner has become everything. The best friend, which in most parts of the world, people do not talk about their spouse as their best friend. They have best friends. When that best friend then hurts you and betrays you and lies to you and falls in love with another person, that's the piece we need to add, you experience such a massive devaluation. It's not just the breach of trust and the betrayal and the lies. It's also you feel like you become worthless. And it really takes, and there's another piece. For most of, you know, for a long time, if you just found a little receipt somewhere and maybe a little bit of lipstick, but today you get the digital archive. I had a father last week in one of the talks in where was I, LA, and, you know, his 21-year-old gets a message via Facebook through a friend. You know, the first message she gets is the woman who's banging the boy she's seeing for the last few years. Then she starts to get all the material, and it's like a death by a thousand cuts after you've read 5,000 messages. You know, how do you... It's not even that you imagine it anymore. It's right there. It's right there. And then when you come and you tell me that you want to rebuild, how am I supposed to believe that?
Well, how long should it take to recover? You talked to one couple.
2 years.
2 years. Because you talked to one couple and he'd had a secret affair for 8 years. And again, the wife completely humiliated, you know, gobsmacked by this. And he didn't understand why she wasn't getting over it, because I'm back. And you said to him, "You've known about this for 8 years. It's going to take her," but you say 2 years.
I said to him, "Your nightmare just may have ended, but hers has just begun. And that is going to take some time." And when she asks you the same question over and over again in that obsessive rumination, she's not doing this to annoy you. She's doing this because she's trying to piece the pieces together, which are just not even able to be pieced together anymore because they're in smithereens.
In smithereens. But how much should you piece together? I mean, I'm going through, there's so much in here. I'm just going through some of the things you touch on. How much should you tell someone?
Ah, to tell or not to tell?
Yeah.
To tell or not to tell is a question that is, first of all, in very much a question that needs to be put within a power structure of a society. I'll give you an example. How many of you are therapists? Quite a few. In the United States, therapists have a real issue about holding secrets, especially this secret. You can have taken all the life savings out of the account, and nobody seems to have an ethical issue holding that secret. But this one is really, no, it's an important thing. And if I go to Mexico, every therapist works with secrets. Because what it means is that if I am going to reveal what may have happened to this woman, she loses her house, she loses her family, she loses her children, meaning the consequences are not equal. And before you decide to divulge, you need to know what are the consequences.
And you're talking about divulge if you're doing couples therapy.
It's true in society as well. I mean, we believe here that honesty is a matter of transparency. We believe in the moral cure of confession. Many parts of the world believe that honesty has to take into account what it will be like for the other person to walk around with that information. And the honor and the preservation of the face is a part of it. As a consequence, the notion that lying can be protective for many people here is inconceivable. In many other parts of the world, it is totally obvious. And it's these nuances, when you talk about to tell or not to tell, if a person asks a question to a friend, to anybody, I always say, do you want to know the answer to your question, or do you want me to know that you have the question? Sometimes you just want to be able to blurt out loud, I wonder if, but you don't want to hear the answer because you can never take it back. And trust is an active engagement with the unknown. It is a leap of faith. You don't trust more because you know all the details.
Well, I was going to say, what about between the two in a couple when you're counseling them? And, you know, when the questions start, when a couple's trying to get back together again, did you do this? Did you do that? Mm-hmm. Did you go this place, that place? How much do you tell?
So I think there are two kinds of questions. There are detective questions and there are investigative questions. Detective questions is, where did it happen? How many times? Did she scream? How many times did she come? Did you do it like this? This is really that. It's like the kind of thing that will keep you awake for months. And usually your imagination will be more salacious than the other people involved. The investigative questions, I have 150 of them, are really about, why did this happen? What does this mean? You know, what did you find out there? Why could you not come to me about this? Did you think about the children? Did you want me to find out? Are you relieved I found out? Do you want me to forgive you? Do you think you are forgivable? Would you respect me more if I didn't forgive you? This brings a whole different conversation, and more importantly, it makes the person on the wounded side much more empowered, much more empowered. By definition, you will never know everything. You need to know a bunch of things. I mean, there's some basic facts you need to know, but the details, it is an affair. That's what it's called. They're probably, let me tell you, this is, you can't make this up, you know. You can't make this up. This is one of my favorites. It goes like this. Nothing happened. That's one of the things people will say, right? Is the common refrain of the sexual literalists. After a few too many drinks at his co-worker's Abby's birthday party, Dustin accepted her invitation to stay over. When quizzed about it the next day by his girlfriend, Leah, he repeated those two words insistently. All right, since you must know, we slept together in the same bed. But I'm telling you,
nothing happened.
At what point does something happen, I wonder? Leah, meanwhile, is plagued by her own questions. Did they get naked? Did she sleep in his arms? Did he brush his nose against her sleeping face? Did he get hard? Is all of that really nothing? The stories make a critical point that many affairs are less about sex than about desire. The desire to feel desired, to feel special, to be seen and connected, to compel attention. And all these carry an erotic frisson that makes us feel alive, renewed, and recharged. It is more energy than act, more enchantment than intercourse. And even when it comes to the act of intercourse, the adulterous defense system is impressively agile at finding loopholes. People grow to great lengths to take the sex out of sex. Clinton wasn't the first. I didn't know her name. It wasn't sex because I didn't know her name. No one came. I was drunk. I didn't enjoy it. I'm not sure I remember the details. It was with a gender that I don't usually have sex with. No one else saw it. We still had our clothes on. We still had some of our clothes on. One foot was on the floor. And you want people to tell you the truth?
Yeah.
It's like...
Well, why does it happen? You list many things. And you spoke about how it seemed that you were saying that it doesn't usually happen unless there's something that that person is missing, usually in themselves. But that still sounds as if the blame goes on the person left behind.
Right.
Because it sounds as if, well, that person didn't provide it. And that's usually how it's interpreted. The person who's left behind feels like, I didn't do something. So why does it happen?
People mind the meanings and the motives of their affair in a host of reasons. Some of them have to do with the relationship. Resentment, loneliness, sexual frustration for decades on end. We talk about the cheater as the person who went to seek comfort elsewhere, but we don't talk about the person who refused them for a decade before that. Betrayal happens in many ways in a relationship, and those things don't get spoken about because this one has taken on a kind of moral superiority, you know, contempt, indifference, neglect, violence. I mean, you know, it started for me with one man that I, you know, and he was, you this and you that and you, and I'm like thinking to myself, well, the first thing I thought is maybe nobody wants to be with you because you're not too nice. But he has been mean, abusive, mean. And so finally I had to say to him, you know, Mr., betrayal comes in many forms. I mean, you really think that this is the first time your wife may actually have encountered someone who is kind, loving, who values what she has to say, who thinks she's smart. You want to talk about she cheated? Of course she cheated. But you know, the vows have been broken in many ways before. And that's not to make a moral relativism, but that's to bring people into a level of accountability. It's not I did this because of you. Two people are responsible for a relationship. One person chooses to have an affair. Always. Always. But there is a context. And the parts, when you pick a person, you pick a story. And you live that story. And sometimes you've been recruited for a play that you didn't audition for. That's your relationship. And yet many things are important in your relationship that don't have to do just with the quality of the connection between you and your partner. And while this is happening, this is why it became so, took me 2.5 years, because every time I said something, something else came to tell me it's not so simple. You know, you want to make it simple and it's not. You know, here is this person. It's one of the episodes in the podcast that of the second season. And he, you know, there, she found out that she has an STI while she goes to her doctor. And of course, we know where it comes from. And in the middle of talking about how he went to his massages with the happy endings, and they're called all kinds of happy endings, she also talks about how he's been taking care of her alcoholic brother and how he's been visiting her mother in the nursing home, and what an amazing father he is. And all of that coexists as she's saying to him, how could you do this? We built this amazing thing. You just destroyed the whole thing. And it's all happening at once. And so why did he do it? From where he sits, he will say, you know, I mean, there is a history of violence. That's one major piece. There's a bit of trauma, quite a bit of trauma for him. But the main reason is he has no idea that when you're unhappy, you should say something. I mean, as many men have learned. That is not her fault. There's no fault in this. I really think that it's very important to not just get so easily seduced by a blame model. An accountability model is not the same as a blame model. And there are two kinds of justice. There's always two systems. There is a punitive justice system and there is a repairing justice system. Do you want to punish the other person or do you want to repair with the other person? And the South Africans understood that very well in their Truth and Reconciliation Commission. You don't apologize.
How do you get from one to the other, though? How do you get from, if, let's say it was a relatively happy marriage, somebody wasn't denying sex for 10 years, and that person is coming to see you because they do want to move from the hurt, the humiliation, the rage, the shock, the falling to pieces, to building something back. How do they cross that?
The first thing, anytime you have an acute experience like that, traumatic experience like that, you need the person who hurt you to acknowledge it. This is what's happening in the public domain here for the last 3 weeks. You need a person that comes and says, I did this to you. I hurt you, I betrayed you, I lied to you, I did all these things. You acknowledge, you show the remorse, and you show the guilt for hurting the person. Even if what you've just experienced was a unique thing in your life that you will forever cherish. These two sometimes need to coexist. If you want only to tell the person that they have to feel terrible about this, when for some of people this is the first time they actually experience, they will not be able to come forward. You need to be able to give them a place to say, I hurt you, without saying, I'm bad.
And without saying, it meant nothing.
It meant nothing. It meant nothing.
If it did, in fact, mean something.
That's right. That's yeah. right.
Well, you say when this happens, this fragile trying to get back, that marriages light up like a scoreboard, you know, 3 points for this side and 4 points for that side. How do you navigate that? Well, you did this, but you did this.
I think the scoreboard is a little different. You know, I have a whole sequence that I take people through and only at the end, it goes through a crisis phase, an insight phase, and then a vision phase for later, and that may be together or not. Really, I think that we have come to a place with the longevity of our lives where we cannot use longevity as the only marker of success. These relationships were not failures because this happened, and that repositioning has to happen. The scorecard.
Yeah.
The scorecard is that in every relationship, you know, there are compromises you make. There are things you give up. There are things you stop asking. There are things you accept for the greater good. And, you know, when one person strays, it's as if that person wanted something more, as if the other one didn't. That's not necessarily the case. The other one may not have chosen to do this. That doesn't mean they're very happy with this. And one of the ways you recalibrate is you actually say to this person, all these compromises that I made, they tell you, you know, when this was the story we had, I was willing. But now, no, I demand more too. And actually that newfound sense of entitlement is one of the most curative factors on the part of the person who is hurt. The fact that you don't just, the fact that this opens up for you the possibility to ask for more is very, very important.
Talk about the three different types of couples that you've seen. You mentioned the explorers, the sufferers, the builders.
So the sufferers are people who are I call them the supplicants, you know. They are mired. Every time you are 5 minutes late, I will remind you what happened. You have lost your entitlement quota for the rest of your life. You owe me big time. I will not even be close to you because if I'm close to you, even if I'm intimate with you, I will feel like I let you get away with it. So I hold this over you the whole time. There is no possibility for repair at all. And it's a little bit, resentment is like swallowing poison and waiting for the other person to die. And there is nothing else. It's just they can't with and they can't without. They can't leave. They are in a position of stable ambiguity, too afraid to leave, and too immature to actually do the work and recommit.
I have to mention one thing that you recommend when, before they get back to that, they're back together and they're going forward, which is what you're talking about, when they're considering it, when they've just found out about the affair. Is it a resentment notebook? Revenge notebook. So that you write down things in the notebook. I think you said only 7 minutes a day. I want to know how you came to that. And then you close it and put it away. But every, you know, the killing that you want to do, the murder.
Where do you find that? In the Bible.
Yeah, you put
Bible
that in your notebook.
With revenge stories.
But you could feel like that.
Right, and there is something about writing it by hand that is extremely cathartic. The amount of ways people have decided to destroy another person, it's limitless, you know.
Why 7 minutes?
Oh, because it's a mystical number, just for no reason,
yeah. Okay.
No reason. It doesn't matter. These things are metaphors rather than literal. But there were two topics that I heard more and more about and that are often lacking, actually, in the general literature. The entire literature on infidelity, the psychology literature in the US, doesn't mention jealousy. It really prefers to talk about trauma. Only in the opera they're jealous, and they kill out of jealousy. And I just thought jealousy is an erotic rage. When you are jealous, you're fighting for something, you're not just crushed. And I would like to tap into this. So jealousy, revenge, they kind of live, you know. And I thought, you don't want to really destroy everything, but you want to have many fantasies for destruction, and these fantasies are often quite liberating because they give you back a sense of power at a moment when you feel completely disempowered and powerless. And that is nothing I write is for everybody, and neither is the entire approach not for everybody. Really, I think the main thing is that you understand that it is so complex that it can't be a one-size-fits-all.
The jealousy is healthy if it's the green monster, not the black monster.
Yes.
The one that can, lead to fisticuffs with the other person. But you were talking about the people who just seem to suffer with what the relationship was before. Who are the builders?
The builders are people who often see this whole thing as a temporary state of insanity that just shook them at their foundation, that shook the foundation of intimacy and trust, they really want to get back to normal. Normal is family life, no divorce, children together, and they want to continue, hold the fort. And they rarely talk about it again. They write to me. I mean, I've received 1,500 letters after the TED Talks. And the people who write the most are the women who stray and the men who are hurt, because those are the two groups that don't get permission to talk publicly. And they wrote from all over the globe, because the story isn't over inside, but it's not part of the conversation. I don't want to know about it. And there's some calm that comes back, some structure, some reassurance, and it's very, very important for them, and it feels right to do it like that.
And then the explorers, tell us more about that.
The explorers are the people who tell you this is probably the most painful thing we went through, but our relationship is much better today than it ever was. Much more honest, much deeper, much more open. We wish we wouldn't have to go through this. But sometimes, in some relationships, it's the death knell. But in other relationships, it's the alarm system that jolts people out of a state of complacency and laziness in which they haven't paid attention to each other in a long time. People spend a lot more time at work. People spend a lot more time with their children. And they spend a lot less time with each other, while at the same time having expectations for the intimate relationship that is at an all-time high. How are we supposed to do this? So this, in marriage, sometimes you start out face-to-face or in any long-term relationship, and then after a while you start to live side by side. It takes one crisis, all kinds of crises, not just this one, and it puts people back face to face. And it's this that the explorers then capitalize on.
What if people don't make it? Do you recommend a separation, if I got that right, a separation ritual?
Yes.
That?
Because I thought we have so many rituals to get married and we have nothing when we end, except some divorce lawyers most of the time. It's really terrible the way people end. And the notion that the end is a shame, I'm 35 years with my husband. When I say that, people clap like it is that notion of longevity as what does it say about the relationship? What does it actually tell us? Many people had parents here who never divorced and they were miserable with each other for decades. But that was the norm, So when people don't make it, and it's possible, not everybody, I say we're going to say goodbye. And it is one of the most poignant parts of the book, is this couple that says goodbye to each other. I've done it many times, but I wrote about one of them. And she's still holding on. She really still wants it and hopes, and he's so gone. He's so gone. And it's when he reads the letter. It's a letter about what they will give each other, what they remember for each other, what they want the other person to take away with them. I do this without infidelity. I do separation rituals a lot because it gives people a very different way of living. But as she listens to him, she realizes he's gone, and it is the first time that she lets go. Her letter
is, I'll always remember your smell when we did this, this, and this, your balding head, and then his is, this was a good partnership. it was so painfully obvious.
And you know, I you will be a good mother to our three children. And I mean, but it was so clear. I had known these people 22 years before when they got married. They had come to see me. And they came back at this stage. So it was, she basically writes, you know, we began with Esther and we ended with Esther. And I was in tears and we are all like a puddle.
Yeah.
But sadness and pain is a part of this experience, as are many other elements. But in that moment, I think that I do anything I can for people to end with dignity and integrity. And the ending with integrity is also ending the affair. Yeah. Because so many times something is found out and then that's it. And so the other person is left hanging after somebody may have promised them for 3-4 years, I'm coming next week, we're going to be together. I mean, people lie, they've lied here, they've lied everywhere. It's a mess. It's a real mess. But that person deserves a goodbye. And I think that some of the partners realize that if their partner actually gets to end the affair with integrity, they will respect them more. It's are you all okay? Are you like...
Yes, I know. It's we definitely have to pay her. We are going to end with integrity right now. Esther Perel. And we're going to have anyone who wants... Yes. Anyone who wants to ask a question... We're going to start the question portion. So the microphone's right here. And if you would just line up, we'll start the question portion. And we only have 15, 20, five minutes for that. Sorry. Wow. 5 minutes for that. But if we want to get a couple questions in, let's do that. And while we do that, did you actually ask one woman who she's back with her husband, very much wanted to have the relationship be back together, but she was still having trouble finding some place to put the other woman whose name she knew. And you actually suggested that maybe she even make a little altar to her.
Yes.
And thank it every day, and thank her every day, the other woman, for what in this case was a reigniting of the embers of her marriage.
Right. It's called paradox therapy. You know, please don't take this literal. I mean, one of the articles took that sentence as, can you believe what she does? I just joked with her. I said, you know, rather than trying to make this person get out of your mind, she's been so catalytic, such a catalyst for you. Maybe you should actually make a little altar for her. This only works if people laugh with you and they understand prescribing the ordeal. When you prescribe an ordeal, you take power over the symptom, over the thing that disempowers you. And so, on occasion, I have rather unorthodox ideas, and I just said, you know, you actually may want every morning to get up there and say thank you. And we're all laughing, but she gets the point that if she says thank you, then she's not going to think you destroyed you. And she was livid with jealousy against this woman, and I thought, this is one way that you can, subvert. You subvert her power. That was the idea.
And it worked. Oh, we have a question.
Hi. Just have a question.
Can you come closer to the mic, please?
If having an affair is a question, a person is trying to be something different themselves, and themselves are trying to be somebody that's different, is there any way to prevent that before a person gets married, he looks at himself so that he cannot, that or she won't go there? Is there something, or even when they're married,
yes.
are there okay. warning yes. signs where a person, you know, is tempted, they can do something to prevent it from happening? So, you know, from your knowledge.
The more parts of you you bring into a relationship, the less likely you are to need to go looking for the missing part elsewhere. But many times, people come with the intention of bringing those parts, and in the relationship, it becomes clear that that's not okay. It's just not okay. And then something that would have been private goes underground and becomes secret. In many gay couples, it's very common to look together at other people, other men, and to talk about who's cute and who's attractive, etc. It's part of the erotic landscape of a couple. In many heterosexual couples, that is not so easy, because the minute you have attractions to others, once again, it means I'm not enough. This is the curse of relationship these days. I'm not enough. It's the curse of modern life, I think. But, you know, so if I'm not enough, then you can't share this with me. If you can't share this with me, which could have become a real intimate conversation about talking about, you know, where we've been before, who we've known, etc., or where we have our desires drawn to, that reinforces a relationship. It actually doesn't weaken it.
So openness.
Openness is
and knowing each other well.
Open relationships are not about avoiding infidelity. Open relationships are about people who want to find a way to marry together, the need for commitment and stability with the need for individual freedom, individuality, and self-expression. And sexuality becomes a part of that. Often by people who seek for the relationship to last, most often done by the people today who are the children of the boomers, who are the divorced and the disillusioned. So I don't think that non-monogamy, consensual non-monogamy, polyamory is a deterrent. It happens in many relationships. And why does it happen in open relationships too? Because transgression is fundamental to human nature. And so even in relationships where people have the permission to do all kinds of things, they still will go for the one thing they were not supposed to.
But, and you're not talking, it doesn't have to be on the level of having an open relationship. It can be about talking about who do you think is an attractive woman or who do you think is an attractive man.
90% is an open conversation.
Yeah.
When you have an open conversation, you actually have, it doesn't really matter if the relationship will be open or not. That depends on people. It's not for everybody, and it's at certain parts in one's life. There's a whole chapter on monogamy and its discontents in the book. But open is the conversation, first and foremost.
Yes.
Hi, I am the victor over infidelity. My ex-husband had numerous affairs, and I now run a support group from Beyond Affair Networks. And in my meetings, sadly, they keep growing and more people are attending, and I have people who are just finding out to people who are years out. So I have a real mixture of people seeking guidance. I'm not licensed. I'm just a woman who has experienced infidelity and know that pain and sorrow. So we try to be a shoulder to lean on. Are there, in such a broad group of people suffering from infidelity, are there any key things that I should be guiding them through? Other than reading your book, which I will recommend.
I was going to say.
And I'm buying multiple copies of, but.
I also, make it a book club.
Right.
I mean, I actually am going to be doing a whole series on my website for people who are going through this experience. But I think that one of the things that I would invite, you know, the people who come to me are probably often self-selected. They listen to the podcast, they read my work, they want to be those people. There's a line I did in the TED Talk, and that became a line that just like, they flocked. It's an amazing thing. I just simply threw out, today in the West, most of us are going to have two or three relationships or marriages. Some of us will do it with the same person. Your first marriage is over. Would you like to have a second one with each other? The people who come to me are inspired by that sentence. They don't want to be bitter and angry and live in the gutter of suspicion for the rest of their life. That's what they seek. But I know that there are plenty of other experiences for people who need other kind of perspective, a different perspective. So what I would say is often the support becomes a rallying that at times it empowers the person, it gives you a sense of community. You are so alone, you have nobody to talk to about this. That's the first beauty of that I think all the networks of support are offering. But sometimes it also becomes, the power comes from a very black and white view of the relationship in which there was one villain and one person who was good. And that, I think, doesn't help the person on the wounded side. It it's so difficult because the minute you say that, it goes to what Robin said. That means you're blaming the victim. That means that you're shifting the responsibility. Absolutely not. But a relationship is a complex system in which people have all kinds of actions and reactions. And I think that everybody who lives this kind of an experience needs to be able to say not just, my partner was a cheater. They have to be able to be more broad about what they went through so that they can have a different experience later on.
Thank you. You know, and by the way, thank you for your work, this woman.
Yes.
You know, we're going to have to wrap this up. Otherwise, we're going to be the Sunday church service, and that's weird. Again, the website, the TED Talks, the podcasts, the book, Esther Perel, thank you so much.
Thank you.